can. Okay, good evening and welcome everyone. Wonderful to see you. Extra points for those who are sharing their video screens. Wonderful to see your smiling faces. Tonight I want to start with you a short series that I've called The Zionists, Portraits of the Jews Whose Dreams We Live Today. Whenever we talk about Zionism or the history of Israel, there's kind of a open and difficult question as to where to begin. And you can make a strong case for saying that, you know, the history of Zionism and the history of Israel should start with, you know, Abraham or Yehoshua or David HaMelech. You can make a case that it starts with Herzl. You could start in 1917 or 1947. So rather than pick a specific date, what I wanted to do in this series is introduce you to a few of the prominent individuals, the important personalities who were involved in the founding of the Zionist idea or Zionist ideas. Some of the individuals that we'll study together will be known to you and familiar to you, and some maybe less so. It's a little bit of a misnomer to talk about Zionism before, you know, Herzl and before it coalesced into a movement. So if it's more helpful, we can think about some of the people that we'll talk about as pre-Zionists or proto-Zionists, forerunners of the Zionist movement. Tonight, I want to start with a man called Yehuda Alkali. Okay, so a couple words of note or of introduction. We're basically talking about the 19th century. So what was going on, you know, kind of facts on the ground, what was going on in Israel or in Palestine in the 19th century? So, you know, for hundreds of years, there was a continuous presence of Jews in Palestine. And that community was often very small. Sometimes you'll visit, you know, Tzfat, and you know they'll talk about the famous community of Tzfat in the 16th century. You know, by the time you get to the 17th, 18th century, there's nothing going on in Tzfat. In the 19th century, the center of Jewish life has moved to Jerusalem. Anyone want to guess? I'll just pick a kind of random date, but it's actually an important kind of period to think about. How many Jews are living in Palestine in 1844? How many Jews living in Palestine in 1844? I see Rona knows the answer. She actually knows. She gave the answer last time I asked this question. So the answer is about 5,000 Jews in Palestine and 5,000 Jews in Jerusalem, rather, and about 7,000 Jews in Palestine. Okay, so that's a tiny, tiny number. And the real waves of migration begin in the 1880s. And, you know, later on in this series, I hope we'll have a chance to talk about the pogroms in Russia and some of the causes for mass migration to Palestine, mass immigration to Palestine in the 1880s and subsequent decades. So in 1882, you have 24,000 Jews living in Palestine. By the time you get to 1914, when you get to World War I, we already have almost 100,000 Jews living in Palestine. And obviously that number goes up exponentially in the interwar years and then after the Holocaust, after World War II. Okay, so we have not a huge number of Jews in Palestine at this time. So I want to introduce you to a man called Yehuda Alkali, who was born in 1798, a man of Sephardic extraction, born in Sarajevo. In his youth, he studied in Jerusalem. Okay, this is all part of the Ottoman Empire. He was a Kabbalist, and Kabbalah is going to factor into a lot of what we talk about tonight. And he took a position as a rabbi, as a teacher, in a town which was called Zemlin or Zemun in 1825 at the age of 27. Okay, so I'll just put up a couple images on the screen. So this is a photo. I think this is really the only photo we have, or the only one that I know of. Of Rabbi Alkali. This is very late in his life. This is already I think 2 years before his passing, a picture of Rabbi Alkalai and his wife. And here I just put a map on the source sheet for you, so you can get a sense of where we are. We're basically in Belgrade. Okay, that's this Zemun, which is, I think, basically a suburb of Belgrade in present day Serbia. It's not a big town. The town, if you investigate it or Google it or visit it, you'll find is famous for one reason. It's because Copernicus lived, not at the same time, but many years earlier, Copernicus lived in this little town. By the time we're talking about the lifetime of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, so there are 5,000, roughly 5,000 people, right? Small town, 5,000 people in Zemun. And it's right at the border of the Habsburg Empire. And you have all types, right? There's Serbs and there's Germans and there's Croats and there's Slovaks and there's Armenians and there's Jews. And in the kind of childhood and adolescence of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, there's a surge of nationalism, sort of all over, the Habsburg Empire and all over the Ottoman Empire. And there's a Serbian War of Independence. So the Serbian War of Independence sort of lasts a long time and goes in various stages. Not a big expert in Serbian national history, but from 1804 to 1815 is one surge of nationalism. And then there's a separate uprising. And eventually the Serbs gain autonomy from the Ottoman Empire in 1830. Okay, so this is part of the background and life of this man, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. So, nationalism is everywhere. He's introduced really to the idea of Jewish nationalism by one of his teachers, a man called Rabbi Yehuda Bibas, the rabbi of Corfu. And here I want to turn to what I mentioned a moment ago, which was Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai's involvement in Kabbalah, and particularly his interest in Messianic speculation. Okay, so let's learn one of his texts together briefly. He quoted a passage in the Zohar. The passage in the Zohar says, "V'lachen amar Rabbi Dosa yemos Mashiach tafshana." So Rabbi Dosa said something a little cryptic. He said that the days of the Messiah, the Messianic era, will be tafshana, 400 years. So what does that mean? So Rabbi Alkalai says, I'll tell you what it means. Rotzelomar tafshana ha'achronim l'elef hashishi. So he says, what it means is the Messianic era of the world begins 400 years before the end of the sixth millennium. Okay, we are living now in 5782, right? So we're in this period toward the end of the sixth millennium. Rabbi Alkalai is writing this in 1839, and he says the beginning of that 400-year period is the Jewish year 5600. The Jewish year 5600 corresponds to the Gregorian year 1840. So he says 1840 is the beginning, is the launch of this Messianic period, and it's a very important period. And he seizes on this idea, which hadn't gotten a lot of play until this time, which is the notion of there being two messianic figures. We say the ultimate Mashiach is the Mashiach ben David, but there's a penultimate Mashiach, a precursor to Mashiach ben David, called Mashiach ben Yosef. And this figures very prominently in the thought and the writings of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. He says there's going to be a figure called Mashiach ben Yosef, and he's going to fight a war, and don't be worried if Mashiach ben Yosef actually dies in that war. That's all part of this messianic advent, and this becomes a kind of obsession for Alkalai. So something then happens in 1840 of great historic import. So what happens in 1840? So, somehow because of the way we teach Jewish history, this event is not that well known, but I'll circle back to it in a second. It's actually very, very important for a couple reasons. in Jewish history. And the event that I'm thinking of is the what became known as the Damascus Affair. Okay. So what's the Damascus Affair? Just by a show of hands, have you heard of the Damascus Affair? So what's the Damascus Affair? So as I always like to say, you know, I'm jealous as a student of history. So I do like, you know, 17th, 18th century history, but the period that I study, you have very limited sources. Once you start getting to the 19th century, 20th century, especially, so you have newspapers. And if something important happens in the world, somebody's covering it. They might do a good job. They might do a bad job. Their reporting might be accurate, might be a little less accurate, but somebody's on the spot writing about it with some sense of urgency and presumably some sense of authority. You know, there's a reporter, there's an editor. So, you know, it's not made up out of whole cloth, and you're not going to sell papers if what you're reporting is, you know, totally not true, except maybe in the 21st century. But in 1840, presumably what you're reading in a newspaper is, you know, has some level of authenticity. So I just want to share with you an excerpt from the Times of London. Okay, put it on your source sheet. Times of London, April 18th, 1840. Actually, took them a couple months to report about this, or they were probably reporting on it, you know, in the interim as well. This was a cause célèbre. It was being reported all over the world. Okay, so what was the story? Okay, so rather than giving you the summary, I'll share with you the newspaper account. Okay, so we're in real time. This is being reported in the Times of London in April 18th, 1840. Okay, hopefully you can see it on the screen. Okay, so they had talked about something that was going on in Rhodes, and then the paper reported the following. The other case occurred at Damascus. Here's the case. What happened? Father Thomas, superior of the Spanish convent, went out on the 9th of February, it's old news by now, but February 9th, 1840, accompanied by a servant, and never returned. Okay, so this this Christian pastor goes missing. The head of another convent, called the Monastery of the Holy Land, gave information of the circumstance to the French consul, who applied to the Pasha for assistance to discover the lost Padre in Damascus. It was reported that Father Thomas and his servant had been seen going towards the quarter inhabited by the Jews, Syrian Jewish community, prominent Syrian Jewish community in Damascus. And thither, the Pasha immediately ordered a detachment of soldiers accompanied by masons to pull down walls, lay open vaults, and ascertain whether any persons were concealed. The last place this guy was seen was the Jewish quarter. They think he's been kidnapped. So you know, local authorities dispatched the military to go looking among the Jews for this missing pastor. Father Thomas had caused bills to be posted in different parts of the town, announcing the sale of the effects of a European recently deceased. Okay, so it was an estate sale, and Father Thomas had done some publicity by posting, you know, flyers about this event. One of these bills, which entered the shop of a Jewish barber, was said to have been taken down by the barber and afterwards posted in a different manner from the original posting. Even wafers of a different color had been used in fixing it up. So the barber is now accused of taking down an advertisement and putting it back with different tape. Okay. The priest had caused all the bills to be attached to the walls with eight pure white wafers from his own convent. Whether the barber took offense either at the number or the color of the wafers, not explained. We don't know what happened here, but it's not said that they were disposed in a cruciform order. Be this as it may, the wicked Jew. Okay, this is an objective newspaper, Times of London. The wicked Jew is said to have replaced the bill by two wafers only, a blue and a red, one at the top, the other at the bottom. This was proof enough. Unbelievable. Nothing could be clearer to all Damascus than that there was a conspiracy among the Jews of which the barber was the chief agent. Okay, you can't make it up. But there's now a blood libel. He's arrested. He was arrested, as was also the servant of Mr. David Arari, another Jew who had been the bearer of some messages between him, his master, and the barber. The two prisoners were first bastinadoed. Okay, you haven't seen that word used earlier in the day. Then they were put into separate cells with soldiers beside them to prevent the enjoyment of a moment's repose. They were obliged to remain constantly in upright position, and then they were showed any symptoms of drowsiness. They were roused by a severe beating. No less than 64 Jewish children were arrested in the hope of obtaining from them some evidence of the crime alleged against their parents. Afterwards, seven other Jews, including David Harari, already mentioned, were arrested. The barber was put to torture. Okay, this goes on for months. Eight Jews are arrested and tortured on the theory that they've kidnapped and murdered this Christian minister to use his blood for the baking of matzahs. You know, this is the springtime with Pesach coming, a classic blood libel happening in the middle of Damascus in 1840. So what happens? One of the Jews who's arrested actually confesses. Of course, he's just doing it to avoid being tortured further. And another dies while he's in prison. Until finally, Jews all over the world, including in the United States, band together, begin a kind of political activism campaign. Moses Montefiore is very involved. Political pressure is applied by important nobles, again, both in the United States and in Europe. And finally, enough pressure is applied that the Ottoman authorities release the Jews. So let me zoom out for a second and say something from a wide angle lens, and then zoom back in to Rabbi Yehuda Alkali. So why is this event so important? So historians basically mark the Damascus affair as the beginning of the Jewish press, right, with a small p, in the sense that Jewish media outlets, or to the extent they existed, Jewish newspapers took up this cause to rile the troops and to alert Jews all over the world about what was going on in one far corner of the world, in Damascus. So beginning of Jewish media. And really the beginning of Jewish politics, right? You couldn't have a story like this in 1640, in 1340, right? Some Jews are being oppressed in Paris. What are the Jews in London going to do about it? Right? They have no authority. They have no clout. They have no levers to pull. But now, some Jews have been emancipated. Some Jews have established themselves as being politically influential. Now there's actually something to do, and this is like the first success story of Jewish political activism on a international scale. If not for Jewish intervention, right, those eight Jews in Damascus may have just rotted away in prison for the rest of their lives. Seven of them are ultimately freed, and it's a great success, even though, of course, to begin with, it's a terrible tragedy. So, the Damascus affair for Alkali shaped his view of redemption. Okay, for kind of two reasons. On the one hand, he saw the blood libel as like this terrible signal of what can and does happen when the Jewish people are without influence and without a homeland. If you're just at the mercy of foreign governments in the diaspora, this is what happens. And at the same time, the sense that there could be influential Jews all over the world who could actually accomplish something on a grand political scale propelled him to accept this sense that, like, we don't have to just sit and grin and bear it. There's actually something to be done. We have influence. We have potential to be the arbiters of our own destiny if we so choose. Okay. So the first books that he had written were actually published in Ladino, and they weren't big sellers. They had a very limited audience. But then he began to publish in Hebrew, so that his works could be known to a much wider audience. So he starts traveling. He starts traveling throughout the Ottoman Empire and throughout throughout Europe. I'll just share with you one excerpt. You could actually find this online. The whole thing is, you know, it's amazing. You don't even have to go search an archive anymore or a library. So what's amazing is that in 1852, he gets to London. I don't know how much English the guy spoke. You know, he grew up in Serbia. Who's helping him? I don't know. But he publishes this book, you know, this pamphlet called Mevaser Tov in English, right? Because he's trying to appeal to the Jews of London to drum up business for his, you know, pre-Zionist ideas, which include the sense that we have to get off our dime and return to the land of Israel. So I'll just share with you one excerpt. If I put it on the source sheet, I'm not sure that I did. But I'll share with you. Oh, here it is. I apologize. This is source number 3 on your source sheet. This idea often, namely the sense that the prophets describe two paths of redemption, and we can choose which path we want. He says it's in the power of Israel to choose either of these modes. If they continue in their apparent apathy about the return to their land, God will arouse them by force. Okay, so you could wait around and do nothing, and you know Hashem is going to bring Mashiach one day. But if we're just, you know, sitting around, so it's not going to go smoothly. Or, right, the other choice is, but if they remember beloved Jerusalem and set about obtaining it as directed by Hosea in the second chapter, gladness and joy shall accompany them, as it's spoken by Jeremiah in the 31st chapter, for thus saith the Lord, sing with gladness for Jacob, shout among the chiefs of the nations, publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. Turn again, O daughter of Israel, turn again to these thy cities. He sits and he publishes and he writes and he preaches, right? The choice is yours. You could sit around and wait, or you could actually, do something. So over time, he developed a quite elaborate plan that, you know, I would say could be distilled into 5 principal points. Point number 1, the introduction of a tithe to finance settlement in Israel. He wanted every Jew living wherever they're living, okay, and they're scattered all over, right? They're in Poland and Lithuania and Russia and Amsterdam and London and Virginia and South America, right? This is North Africa. Wherever you are, it's the responsibility of all Jews all over the world to contribute to the settlement of the land of Israel, whether you are planning to, you know, be a settler or not, point number 1. Point number 2 is he said, we need the restoration of a Sanhedrin. If we're going to be a political entity, we need political leadership. And so there needs to be the reinstitution of the Sanhedrin. Point number 3, and again, this sounds so obvious to us sitting here, you know, in 2022, having just celebrated the, you know, Yom HaAtzma'ut for the 70th odd time, but he says we need to revive Hebrew as a spoken language. Again, Hebrew had always been the language of our liturgy, had always been the language of rabbinic discourse. It had always been the language of, you know, yeshiva education. But as a spoken language, you know, he's in the 1850s. Who's thinking of reviving Hebrew as a spoken language? And Yehuda Alkali says, yeah, we need to revive Hebrew as a spoken language. By the way, we'll fast forward. We'll get to this eventually. It was not obvious that Hebrew was even going to be the national language of Israel. Right, they were debating it in the early part of the 20th century. right? So there was a movement to make Yiddish the language. There was a, they thought, right? Herzl thought it was going to be German. Irony of ironies, right? Okay, so already in the 1850s, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai is saying we need to revive. We need to revive Hebrew. Point number four is he said we need to invest in Jewish agriculture. The only way that Jewish settlement is going to work is if we can make ends meet by working the land. Okay, and point number five, also totally radical idea to be talking about in the 1850s. The creation of a Jewish army. Right? I mean, again, who would be thinking about this? Who would be writing about this at a time when, you know, Jews are suffering, you know, anti-Semitism in all parts of the world and have very little political autonomy, or where they've already gained political emancipation and they're free to go about their business in, liberated countries like the United States or England. As the case may be. Let me say a couple more words about Alkali's biography, and then I want to study a couple of texts with you and conclude by thinking about his influence and his legacy. So again, he's traveling all over Europe in the Ottoman Empire, trying to drum up business for his vision. He's not meeting with a lot of success. He, as one can imagine, he mostly meets with opposition, either religious-based opposition, like, you know, we don't really believe that one can bring the Messianic era by our own means, and we have to be more passive. Or he met with kind of practical opposition, like, you know, what kind of crazy pipe dream is this? You know, 1800 years of Jewish diaspora. Why do you think it's suddenly going to change? 1871, Alkali visited Jerusalem again. He'd been there in his youth, and he established a colonization society. But again, it didn't take off. It was a total failure. He's making all these trips back and forth. Finally, in 1874, at the age of 76, he made Aliyah. So it just goes to show you, any age, you can make Aliyah. And he died 2 years later in 1878. And he's buried in on Har HaZeitim, Ad Hayom Hazeh. Okay, so. I want to just pause here to ask if there are any questions or comments, and then I want to share with you a couple of his teachings. Okay. So let's learn together. If you have your source sheet handy, and I'll also put it up on the screen. This is source number five. So, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai wrote a lot about tshuva. I want to introduce you to one of the key teachings that he shared about tshuva, and it's revolutionary on the one hand, but actually quite obvious and simplistic, or simple rather, on the other. So he differentiates between what he calls tshuva pratit and tshuva klalit. Okay, so he says tshuva pratit. Rotze lomar sheyeshuva chotei mecheto al pi gidrei hatshuva asher gvalo rishonim. He says this is the tshuva that we think of when, you know, we get to Elul and the rabbi gets up and starts telling everyone they should do tshuva, and we have these 10 days. They're called the Aseres Yimei Tshuva. Individual tshuva means, you know, people should repent their sins and do better. Halohem k'suvim b'sefer kech, b'sefer eshiz chachma, b'sefer chobas l'lavavos, b'damn. You have all these works of ethics and musar that teach people how to do tshuva. Yeah, tshuva zos kadmali olam. And this kind of tshuva, you know, predates the creation of the universe. And it's very basic and very important. The last two lines of that paragraph, Lazosti Kratshuva Pratit, Bimnation Itzreches Bipratut, Lechol Ish Veish. Okay, that's why it's called Tshuva pratit, it's individual, individualized, specific, because each person, right, I'm responsible for what I've done wrong, you're responsible for what you've done wrong, I can't do tshuva for you, you can't do tshuva for me. So we understand intuitively that tshuva has to be a self-guided, self-directed process, because I'm the only one who can make amends for what I've done wrong. And of course, it's contingent. If I've done, you know, really terrible things, I need to do much more tshuva. If I've done less terrible things, I could do less tshuva, and so that's the first mode of tshuva. That's the first category of tshuva. Abaha tshuva haklalit. But there's also something called collective tshuva, general tshuva. What's that about? This is, there's something which is much more fundamental, and that's the general return, the return of the Jewish people to the land of our forefathers. And then he goes on, and he, you know, is very knowledgeable about Jewish texts. So he starts quoting you all the Mamre Chazal that extol the virtues of living in the land and castigate Jews of the diaspora for not valuing how much one should pay attention to living in the land. Ki adar b'chutz laretz doma k'mishein lo Eloha. The famous Gemara, it says, one who lives in the diaspora is like a person with no God. V'Yisrael b'chutz laretz ovdei avodah zara b'tzarahem. And the Jews of the diaspora are considered to be idolaters. Okay, and on. The next paragraph, Atshuva HaKlalis Hazot Tzavu Alei HaKol HaNaviim. He says, all the Nevi'im preached that you have to do this kind of tshuva. They always said, right, you have to get back, you have to get back to the you have to get back to the land. Okay. So just jump to the very end of this source, the last paragraph. I'm actually sorry, it's the next paragraph, source number six. So Rav Alkalait writes the following. He says, we got into trouble because the rabbis, like, they changed the meaning of the word. You know, the basic meaning of the word tshuva means that you go back to the place from which you came, right? Like the Navi says, came over tshuva sahara masa. I think that's a pasuk about Shmuel Hanavi, right? He lived in a place called Ramah, and he went back to Ramah. That's what tshuva means. You go back to your place. The Razal, al das ha-sheila, hinichu es ha-shem hazeh l'shev michato. Okay, but the rabbis, like, they appropriated this word to tell you that tshuva is about returning from your sin. Shaya nireh v'nidcheh v'chozer v'nireh. This is to go and come back, like that's what they convinced us of. You go back to Tanakh, you won't find that application of this word. That's just the rabbinic application. Very important. Every generation, we make mistakes, we sin, we need to do tshuva. So we understand why that became the popular meaning of this word. The davar ba kol chach, the diber kol chachma. It became such a popular notion that we forgot the original meaning of the word. For asar rishona nishkachas kemeis b'leiv, we just neglected it entirely. He says, don't forget that the actual meaning of tshuva means that we return to the land of our fathers. And again, it seems so obvious to us living in 2022, but was not obvious to anyone, you know, in 1840 or in 1860. So I just wanted to seize on this paragraph in particular to show you that Rav Kook picked up on this thread. Okay, Rav Kook was well versed in the writings of Rav Alkalai. And you can see just in the bolded part here, just in the interest of time, he says, "Ukeshem shezehu klal gadol etzal yachid kachu etzal hatzibur beklalusa." So he also distinguishes, right? If you're reading Rav Kook, he doesn't quote Rav Alkalai, but it's clearly, emanating from this place where Rav Kook says, the same principle of tshuva that applies to individuals also applies to the nation in general, right? No one had ever said that before. So just, in the English, again, in the interest of time. So he says, this very lyrical and beautiful explanation of what tshuva is all about for the individual. And then he says in the bold, and just as this is a fundamental principle insofar as the individual is concerned, so is it in regard to the community in its totality. The illumining of repentance is within Israel, the awakening of the desire of the nation in general to return to its land, to its nature, to its spirit, to its character. Truly, this striving contains within itself the light of repentance. There's a national spirit of tshuva that is transcendent, right? It transcends, it moves beyond what we consider to be the tshuva pratit, the individual tshuva, the tshuva of, you and me. No, there's something about the community. There's something about the nation as an entity returning and returning to the land. Let me make two final points. So in his own lifetime, Rav Alkalai was, I would say, largely unsuccessful at moving individuals or communities. Right. That being said, he certainly sowed the theological and kind of intellectual seeds of religious Zionism, which became important for future religious Zionist activist leaders and thinkers. And it's possible, right? Scholars have speculated that there was a very important Zionist who may have been influenced directly or indirectly by the thinking of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. The Zionist that they think may have been influenced by the thinking of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai is Theodor Herzl. Why do scholars think that? And again, no one has drawn like a straight line, okay? But I see a lot of lawyers on the line, so you correct me if I'm using this out of place. But we would say there's a circumstantial case to be made for the line between Alkalai and Herzl. So Theodor Herzl was the son of a man called Yaakov Herzl. Yaakov Herzl was the son of a man called Simon Herzl. Where is Herzl from? Herzl's from Vienna. Okay, so we think of him as a Viennese Jew. But where did his family come from before they got to Vienna?
Hungary.
From Hungary. And where did they come from, right, before they got to Hungary? They were
Serbia.
They were in Zemun. They were in Zemlin. His grandfather, Herzl's grandfather, was a member of the shul where Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai was preaching. Herzl's father would have been a kid growing up listening to the sermons of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. So, I don't know if we have Alkalai's books in the library of Theodor Herzl, but it stands to reason, right? It stands to reason that somewhere in the line of the Mesorah of the Herzl family was this tradition of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai and the sense of nationalism, the sense of the meaning that tshuva means a return to Zion, and a sense of urgency about the need to get back to the national homeland in order to bring about, again, from the position of a Kabbalist, right? Alkalai was saying we need to get back to the homeland to bring about the advent of the Messianic era. Herzl was not a Messianist, but for pragmatic and political reasons, he certainly would have agreed with Alkalai that the Jews need to get out of the diaspora and return to a national homeland where they could have sovereignty and autonomy. Want to conclude, before I leave a few minutes for questions, want to conclude with maybe the most haunting words that Alkalai ever penned. I have it for you in the last source on your sheet in Hebrew and in English, and I'll just share the English in the interest of time. So remember, we began by saying, you know, there's the 400 years and 1840, the year 5600, is very, very important. So Alkali's, you know, conceptualization of that time period was functionally in centuries. Okay, so there's 400 years, there's four centuries of this messianic period. He says, if heaven forfend, the Lord spread over us a spirit of slumber, and we not awaken and gather as a united body to see the matter of ingathering, the days of the Messiah, son of Joseph, will be lost, right? For they are in the sixth millennium, i.e., these 100 years, 1840 to 1939. And at the end of the sixth millennium will come the descendant of David with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Remember, he said this in a source we saw earlier, which he always came back to. There's two options here. And he's not saying that you have to do it in 1840. He's saying you have to do it in 100 years beginning in 1840. And if you don't get there by 1940, if you don't get there by 1939, right, then something terrible is going to happen. With an outpouring of wrath, will gather our dispersed by one from the city and two from the town. That's a line from the Zohar. And who will we be by that point? A poor, impoverished people, smitten and tortured, aghast at the evil and consumed by troubles, for not having respected the God of Israel to return and huddle under his cover in the land of Israel. Wow. The Jews should have thus gathered at the beginning of the sixth millennium, because the exile was decreed for 1,000 years. He has left me forlorn in constant misery, the line from Apha. Since the Jews did not awaken to thus come together, hard times of trouble, expulsion, extermination set in. As Rabbi Yeshua wrote in Perek Chelek, but the Holy One, blessed be, will set up a king over them, whose decrees shall be as cruel as Haman's, whereby Israel shall engage in repentance, and he will thus bring them back to the right path. Meaning that if they do not return to the land of Israel, the Holy One, blessed be, will set up a king over them, whose decrees shall be cruel and harsh, and thus cause them to return against their will and not to their advantage. They're going to go back to Israel because they have no choice. For by a strong hand, he shall let them go. By a strong hand, he shall drive them forth from his land, naked and lacking all, as happened to our ancestors who expelled from the Spain and the like. Okay. So in retrospect, there was a prophetic quality to these words. Right, his prophecies functionally fell on deaf ears. Right, in his lifetime, he saw virtually no progress as far as immigration to Israel, immigration to Palestine, a return to the land, the rebuilding of the land. He died in 1878, okay. And writing about what would happen if we didn't get our act together in these 100 years. Sadly, we saw what did in fact. Take place after the expiration of that time period. If only, right, he would, see what we've built, since 1948, right? These are the kind of, literal fruition, the literal realization of these dreams. And that's, why I call this Portraits of the Jews Whose Dreams We Live Today. This was it, right? Israel 2022, the fact that there's a shul in every on every street in Yerushalayim, and there's little kids running around, and the only language that they speak is Hebrew, and the fact that there's a Jewish army defending the sovereign Jewish state. Dreams, right? No one was listening in the 1840s, in the 1850s, in the 1860s, in the 1870s, and yet, right, he sowed the seeds for the conception of religious Zionism that we are blessed to live today. So let me pause here and invite everyone to join us next week at the same time. I'm happy to take questions or comments.